The Guardian.
The festive season is fast approaching, so this year, while you're busy buying gifts for friends and family, why not treat yourself too? This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simple yet powerful all-in-one website building platform. With Squarespace, you can easily create your own website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. It's simple, and it'll be the one gift you know you won't want to return. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code GUARDIAN to get 10% off.
This is a special edition of Science Weekly. This year's Sense About Science lecture is Science, Technology and Democracy, Dissecting the Anatomies of Controversy by Professor Steve Rayner, James Martin Professor of Science and Civilization and Director of the Institute of Science, Innovation and Society at Oxford University.
Good evening. I am by training an anthropologist, and it's sometimes said, perhaps rather unkindly, of anthropologists that for us, data is the plural of anecdote. So I'll begin with a story, a personal story, of the time when I was a young researcher at the Oak Ridge National Lab in Tennessee, and the story is called Why Climate Change is Like a Christmas Tree. In the late 1980s, I actually proposed to the director of the Oak Ridge National Lab in Tennessee that we ought to have a social science program looking at the social and policy implications of climate change at that very early stage. And being, of course, a lab director, he was operating due diligence, and he referred this idea to a committee of greybeards who, for advice as to whether this was a good idea. And one of the members of this committee, who was a former deputy administrator of the US Environmental Protection Agency, stopped me in the corridor of the lab and said, "Steve, I hear you're interested in looking at climate change from a policy standpoint." And I said, "That's right." He said, "You're wasting your time, son." He said, "Climate change will never be a major public policy issue." And I said, "That's interesting. Why do you say that?" And he said, "It's too far in the future. The science is too uncertain, and there's no simple, easy villain to blame." And I said, "I agree with you entirely. Those are exactly the three reasons why climate change is going to become a major public policy issue, because it's like a Christmas tree. Everybody will bring their issue to it and hang it on it." And sure enough, that's what happened in the ensuing two decades. Basically, multiple agendas were loaded onto the climate change issue until we reached the stage at Copenhagen when, to switch metaphors, finally the bandwagon broke, the poor old oxen collapsed and dies, and the wheels fell off the whole approach that was being pursued there. Because basically one issue couldn't bear the weight of all of the development, political, environmental, social, legal and other agendas that were being placed upon it. And successive conferences of the parties since Copenhagen, of course, have tried to prop the thing up. But I think there's increasing recognition today that the real action on climate change is going to come from elsewhere. It's a daunting picture. At the present moment, the world is actually on the top trajectory shown in these IPCC emission scenarios. These are scenarios basically that the IPCC has put together based on a range of stories about how technology might develop over the course of the next century and about how the economy might grow over the course of the next century. And at the present moment, our global emissions are increasing somewhere between 3 and 3.5% per annum, which puts us on this top curve, where we are facing a 2-degree Celsius temperature rise by the middle of the century, and if we stay on that curve, 4 degrees by the end of the century. By the way, I think I'm going to be completely open with you in a way most politicians are not. I believe there is no way we're going to avoid that 2 degrees temperature rise. There is no way that we can cut emissions through conventional mitigation strategies, even if we fully implement them, in time to prevent that from happening because of the time lag in the climate system. But not everyone, of course, is convinced that this is a problem. And this is a slide produced by my colleague Dan Kahan from Yale University, showing how concern about climate change is distributed across the political spectrum in the United States of America. And you can see here that there's a very direct correlation between one's position on a left-right political spectrum and the seriousness with which you actually face or with which you regard climate change as a potential problem for society. Now, you might think that this is something that we could simply refer to science to resolve for us. We would go to the IPCC or other authoritative bodies and get them to tell us what the situation is and, in fact, to communicate even more clearly what it is that the science is telling us. So the standard response to the sceptics is to appeal to science, more science, better science. It's a bit like the English when they talk to foreigners. You know, if they don't understand you, you speak more slowly and loudly, and then they'll get it, right? But unfortunately, that's actually not the way it works. Repeated studies, and this is another one of Dan Kahan's, particularly in the US, but repeated studies in Britain and the US have shown that actually, as science literacy increases, you get more divergence around certain kinds of issues, particularly the issue of climate change, than you have when there is less science literacy. So basically, you can see here the ratings of risks that people gave Kahan in relationship to how they scored on a standard science comprehension test. In other words, in this case, the more you know, the more you disagree, rather than are driven towards a consensus. Now, I want to say that the situation has not, I think, been helped by some activists insisting that science is beyond question. The idea that climate models are completely without any kind of flaw or problem associated with them. But I am convinced that although the climate science is certainly imperfect, that it's at least as good as the information that governments routinely use for making policy decisions, invading Middle Eastern countries, for example. It's at least as good as that routinely used by corporations for new product launches. So let's not hold climate change to a platinum standard that is probably unachievable. Let's relate that science, the state of that science, to the kinds of information that we routinely use to make decisions. So why is that not convincing to those people who seem to be on the right of the political spectrum in the US, and to those people who are remaining sceptical in countries like the UK, which is admittedly less polarised in a binary kind of way, and also in Australia? Why does that happen? There are various kinds of social science insights that could be offered. This is an interesting one derived from Donald McKenzie, professor at Edinburgh University, and he originally devised this to explain the different patterns of credibility that people had towards the accuracy of intercontinental ballistic missiles. So he said that the people who actually produced the intercontinental ballistic missiles had a certain clear acknowledgement of uncertainty, in fact, about how accurate they were going to be. But as you moved away from the coalface of knowledge production into what this area which was described here as configured users, you're talking here about people like officers in the Pentagon, members of the House and Senate defense committees and so on and so forth, then the reservations and the realistic understanding from being close to the point of production knowledge dissolve away. And you have an exaggerated sense of certainty over what those missiles can do, or in this case, an exaggerated sense of certainty about the precise predictions that are made by climate models. And then as you move further away, you find scepticism rises again. And I'm going to talk a little bit about what happens actually as you move away from the configured users and to the divergences of this scepticism as you move from left to right across the Keynes's uncertainty trough. Now, another useful cartoon here. This is actually produced by Silvio Funtowitz and Jerry Rivets. Jerry, for those of you who know his work, by the way, is still active in my institute at Oxford and comes to our regular meetings. And here, basically, what they were trying to do was to map issues according to the degree to which there is uncertainty and ignorance about the issue at hand, and the decision stakes, the societal decision stakes that the issue addresses. And their argument was that when basically the decision stakes are low and the uncertainty is low, you do indeed get consensual science. This is where evidence really counts, because people aren't going to argue about the evidence. Isn't it interesting? The Republicans who complain about climate change science don't argue about the number of particles in the nucleus of beryllium or something like that. This is an area of consensual science. But as you move away from the area where evidence is clear, where you have a lot of actuarial knowledge, and where there's not much at stake in terms of social values, to an area where you're depending very much more on expert judgment. And as you move further away from the origin in either direction, or both directions, you move into an area where, in fact, we find conflict between people's worldviews. Isn't it interesting that people get most heated in arguments actually when their knowledge is the least? And that's the same. That's the case for all of us. And that's because we're falling back on something very fundamental, which is our view of the world and how it works and how it ought to work. So examples of issues here, you might, for example, think about nuclear energy. Something that would be down here in the consensual area might well be a problem of the selection of a pump for a nuclear reactor. Lots of actuarial information, lots of information about the performance of the manufacturer and so on. You can easily make that decision using applied science, technology, and there'd be consensus about that. But as you move out to, say, selecting between alternative reactor types, you might be moving into the area of expert judgment. And then as you move to the issue as to whether, in fact, the country ought to have a nuclear strategy and build more nuclear plants, then you start to be getting into the conflicting worldviews point of view here. So I just want to use this to establish the map here that I'm not talking, for the most part, about the things that are close to the origin. I'm talking about the kind of issues that are at least in the expert judgment and moving out into the conflicting worldviews spaces on this picture. Consensus. The people, particularly who are trying to push the climate change agenda in the United States, have actually been developing a social marketing campaign. And their social marketing campaign is 97% of scientists agree global warming is happening and we are the cause. There's a problem with this. And that's that only 6% of American scientists self-identify as Republicans. So if we're recognising that when you're in that area of worldview, who are you going to trust for information? There's a bit of a disconnect here between the political orientation of the scientists and the political orientation of the people that you're trying to reach with this social marketing campaign. How did the science of climate change get caught up in politics in this way? I have a hypothesis. And that is that when the original congressional hearings were held in the late 1980s, that a number of prominent scientists who went into those hearings in the House of Representatives and the Senate hearing rooms, like these ones down here, said to the politicians, here is the problem, climate change. If you accept our diagnosis, here is the prescription for the disease. Here is the solution. Inadvertently, I think that created a situation in which the scientists had signaled to the politicians that if you didn't like the solution that was being offered, you had to dispute the diagnosis. That was the way to attack the solution. So those politicians who are concerned about the idea that dealing with climate change is going to affect American jobs, is going to disrupt American markets, realised that they had, in a sense, been signposted towards the way in which they had to engage in order to avoid those political outcomes that they want. It is my view that had the scientists constrained themselves at that point to saying, here's the diagnosis, you guys are the politicians, you figure out what to do about this, we might have avoided 20 years of a surrogate argument about science when the real underlying argument is an underlying argument about values. So how does science and values get mixed up in this way? I'll tell you another story, another anecdote. As a philosophy undergraduate, I was fascinated by the idea that philosophers had two sets of ideas. They had ideas about the way the world is, an epistemology, an ontology, and a theory about the way the world ought to be, an ethics and a politics. Not a very novel observation. Bertrand Russell made that, actually, in his History of Western Philosophy. But what caught my imagination was the fact that the theory about the way the world is almost invariably, it seemed to me, reinforced and legitimated the theory about the way the world ought to be. So you hear these two pictures of prominent philosophers making rude gestures at each other. Plato, of course, was very upset with the Athenian state. He didn't think much of democracy because it actually had sentenced Socrates to death by poisoning. Socrates, Plato's great teacher. So Plato had a notion of how the state should be governed by a stable class of guardians who would govern the society in the general interest. A fixed and unchanging, stable political system, not subject to democratic whimsy. His epistemology, his ontology, was that there was a world of forms in which the perfect example of everything we encounter in daily life exists. So somewhere in this world of forms, there is the perfect glass, of which the glasses that we encounter are imperfect projections into the world that we experience. And he used the analogy of the shadows on the cave wall, arguing that we only see the shadows on the cave wall, not the fixed, unchanging object. So his idea about nature seemed to be very consistently supporting his idea about how the world ought to be organised. Now, fast forward a couple of thousand years, you've got Marx and Engels in the pub down the road here outside the British Museum getting terribly excited about boiling water. For heaven's sake, now why would two of the leading European revolutionaries of the 19th century be excited about boiling water? Well, you've already got it, right? You keep pumping heat into it, nothing happens. At 100 degrees Celsius, it turns from liquid to vapour. Okay? So you can see how philosophers have this idea that somehow you can legitimate your moral and political preferences by a particular conception of nature. Nature is the last trump card we play to win arguments. When God, money, and everything else runs out, we revert to nature as the argument. And I discovered as an anthropologist, when I subsequently went in for graduate studies, that it's not just philosophers who do this. Everybody does this all over the world. Except that in the modern world, we seldom encounter anything that we could describe as nature directly. It's mediated by science for us. External nature is mediated by the idea of the environment, by ecology, environmental science. Internal nature is mediated by the idea of medicine. And furthermore, not only is our encounter with nature mediated by science, it's also mediated by technology. A technology which actually takes us out of ourselves and observes ourselves and the world we live in from outside. So as we rely increasingly on satellite data observing the Earth, or we rely on sophisticated scanning technology to look at our insides, at the same time we are changing fundamentally the perspective from which we engage with nature. And this is a picture which I've borrowed from Tim Ingold, a fellow anthropologist. And this is contrasting the world of a philosopher, Maffei, from the early period of the Enlightenment. He is instructing his aristocratic patron about the way of the world, and the idea here is that they are at the centre of a concentric staircase, an inverted cone, and that as you move outwards, you rise up higher and higher in your understanding. But it's the understanding from the inside out, contrasted with the world now from satellite imagery, and in the way I've described also from medical technology, which is very much a world view from the outside in. And as you can see from the quotation there from Ingold, this isn't just a question of scale, it's actually a question of a fundamentally different way of apprehending the world that we live in. So there's a nice example of the tension of these modes of apprehension, which I think plays a role in the very different responses that we've experienced historically in the United States and in Western Europe with respect to genetically modified crops. I'm actually both British and American. I'm a dual national, so I have a foot in both camps here. But I was quite surprised when I came to the UK 12 years ago to come into a situation where there was a lot of controversy about GM foods, because I've been eating them every day for years in the US without even thinking about it, to be perfectly honest. So I was puzzled. And looking into it, I came to the following conclusion, which is it comes down to very much the idea of what people think of when they think of nature. You talk to most North Americans about nature, and what pops into their heads is the wilderness areas. It's the national parks. It's the place where people are not. You talk to most Western Northern Europeans about nature, and they will talk to you about the countryside in which we dwell. And so there's a very different relationship here. Americans dwelling outside of nature, except when they venture into it, and Europeans experiencing it from the inside. And I think there's no delusions in the US. You fly over the Great Plains, you see these massive soy bean factories, open-air factories, manufacturing soybeans, that food production is an industrial process. But we still have these notions of terroir, of regional food production and so on. And so the idea of tinkering with nature isn't something about tinkering with the production process. It's about tinkering with the world in which I live, my very milieu. And it's very interesting to note that even at the height of opposition to GM foods in the UK, the vast majority of people in this country responded to surveys that said that they were quite comfortable with the idea of GM pharmaceuticals. GM pharmaceuticals are produced in factories where those industrial products belong. GM foods, however, the fear was that they were being produced in the world in which people were living. So this difference in standpoint, I think, is something that's quite important to understand. There's also, I think, something that we have to take into account, that a lot of trust in science is actually derived from trust in technology. Locally, experientially, stuff works. I'm interacting with technology here now. You've got your mobile phones. You're all tweeting there, you know. And there is this mental model that I think is still quite pervasive, that somehow or other that science discovers things and technology turns those things into useful inventions. It's a linear notion. It's not actually accurate. The Wright brothers actually made their Kitty Hawk flight long before the development of the science of aeronautics. The science of nanoscience is very much dependent upon the invention of particular kinds of microscope equipment, which actually enables observations at the nanoscale. So very often, in fact, the science is derived from the technology. So it's a very much more complex interactive process. But nevertheless, in the popular imagination, we trust scientists because technology works, and we have this notion that science is at the root of technology. But while technology can both thus undermine and engender trust in scientific claims, direct interrogation lies beyond the scope of most of us. For most of us, actually, it might as well be then a miracle occurs. Although that wasn't the initial intent of Sidney Harris in this cartoon, I think nevertheless it makes the point. So the issue here hangs on trust. But who do we trust? Usually I think there are two factors involved in the decisions about who we trust. One is we trust demonstrated technical competence. In other words, technology stuff works, So we trust on that basis. And the second is we trust people who we identify as being like ourselves in some way. And so we've dealt with the first of these, the stuff work. So I now want to return to people like ourselves. And I come back to Danker-Hahn's graph here. Because actually, when we look closely at the graph, what's interesting in particular isn't just that, in fact, you have this divergence between the left and the right, but that there are actually three distinctive patterns that can be discerned in this picture. It reveals a certain heterogeneity that is not immediately apparent when we think about these issues as simply being polar or binary disputes. The debate isn't simply polarised between left and right. And indeed, if we start to unpack those lines and think about the institutional arrangements that lie behind those patterns of response to climate change, the climate change threat, we see that in fact they fit very well with well-developed social science research, both on institutional trust, what kinds of institutions do different sets of people have confidence in to be both technically competent and to behave in a proper proper fashion, and also different patterns of reliability as people actually practice in scientific labs. So if we look at the institutional literature, we see that in fact there are three ways of organising, three forms of kinds of world outlook. The world should be organised according to people and things in their proper places in a kind of hierarchical way. And that worldview is very consistent with insistence on procedures and following the rules properly in order to get things done. And in fact, when you take that into the lab, as I did with work I did in various hospitals in the Boston area in the 1980s, you find that scientific orientation, which is a control-oriented procedural approach to what goes on in a clinical lab. The whole point is there to reproduce the same conditions over and over again very carefully. Very different from when you get into the medical research labs in the Boston area, where I encountered a gentleman who says, I treat radioisotopes like candy, and his nickname was Three Mile Irwin. And that wasn't seen as pejorative particularly, you know. And that kind of culture, that kind of much more competitively orientated culture, tends to have confidence in the performance of successful individuals. And then thirdly, you have this kind of collectivist institutional arrangement, which trusts participatory institutes that wants affinity groups, town meetings and so on, that the notion that actually we have to talk things through and that's how we come to a proper understanding of the world. And you find actually there in ecology labs this complexity-orientated approach to science where the idea is that you expect the unexpected to happen because, after all, it's a very complex interactive system. So you may well ask, in making the decision who to trust on the climate in terms of climate change, that people are actually operating within this kind of triangular space, looking for information from people who you think is like me, people who think that the world should be organised the way I'm comfortable with organising it, whether it's actually in my scientific practice or in my political viewpoints. And so we have this triangular pattern. And I just want to make a couple of observations here, which is it corresponds very closely to these three icons, which represent the view of nature, which we find is very consistent with those forms of social commitment. So if we find that those who are committed to a collectivist way of apprehending the world tend to see nature as ephemeral. It's like a ball on an upturned cup. Any slight perturbation, you have a catastrophic and non-reversible change in the way the system's operating. It's the idea of the delicate balance of nature. On the other hand, if you're in the competitive mode, you say, actually, that's exactly the wrong way round. The ball is in the cup. I can perturb the cup a great deal, and it will return to an equilibrium state. So you might actually say that Al Gore was very much representing the collectivist view of nature, and George Bush was representing the competitive when he said, we're not going to let climate change upset the American way of life. We can deal with it. And then you have this third one here, hierarchical, which says, OK, the ball is in a surface which you can perturb a certain amount, but not too much. If you perturb it excessively, then you will have an unpredictable change of state. And the problem is, of course, that these guys, Al and George, don't actually need science. They already know how the world works. It's the guys up here who want science. It's the guys up here who are commissioning and carrying out the endless scientific reviews, whether it's the Millennium Ecosystems Assessment or the IPCC report, because what you want to know is how deep is that depression in that landscape? Where is the ball? Is it in the bottom or is it actually close to the top there? So there's always that search for information. Interestingly enough, look what happens when you look at the view of the economy. Did you catch that? Nature, the economy. So as I already mentioned, George Bush wasn't wanting to hazard the American way of life. He was seeing the economy as being very fragile in relation to what meant to many of us would seem to be very modest kind of expenditures on emissions reductions. On the other hand, the Al Gore view of the economy was, I think, represented very much by his investment company, Generation Investment Partners. His partner is actually a guy called David Blood. Why they didn't call it Blood and Gore, I will never know. But, you know, the idea that actually, you'll have a temporary perturbation, perhaps, if you make these big green investments, but the ball will return to an equilibrium state and we'll actually be better off than we were before. And meanwhile, the poor old so-and-sos in the Treasury are scratching their heads thinking, well, actually, what are things going to cost? I need to see the economic analyses, so on and so forth. So you can see here how these different views of the nature and the economy play a fundamental role in the way people are shaping their understanding of nature according to their social commitments to certain sets of values, certain ways in which they see society ought to be organised. Now, if, as I have argued, science cannot simply trump worldviews when decision stakes are high, which is the crux of my argument so far, how on earth can we come to grips with issues like climate change? And this is where I take heart from a dictum of Walter Lippmann's. I've never been able to nail down the exact source of this quote, so I can't vouch for it word for word. But he is known to have expressed the view that democracy is not about getting people who think differently to think the same way. It's about getting people who think differently to do the same thing. And I think that's an important way in which we have to reframe our approach here. Getting people to do the same thing for different reasons is probably best achieved by reframing the problem. And reframing the problem has been the goal of this series of publications that I've been involved in since the 1990s, the latest of which you can see on the right there is the book that Tracy showed you earlier. Reframing is appropriate in any case, I would argue, because in fact the mainstream policy approach to climate change through the Kyoto mechanisms, the Framework Convention and so on, I think was misinformed by three very attractive but ultimately misleading analogies. Ozone depletion, sulfur pollution and strategic arms. The way in which ozone depletion informed the climate policy architecture was largely by looking at the structure of having a framework agreement that was then followed up by implementation protocols. So you had the Vienna Convention on ozone substances depleting the ozone layer. At that time, the efforts by certain countries, the US and Scandinavia, to have an aerosol ban didn't come to fruition. You then had a period of maturation of the issue with a lot of cross-national conversations between NGOs and scientists and businesses and so on, until they came to the Montreal Protocol, which agreed to phase out and ultimately under the London amendments ban the production of chlorofluorocarbons altogether. So the lesson we learned from that, or drew from that in designing the climate policy architecture, was this idea of treaties and protocols. Wrong lesson. This is a very simple problem. It's one gas produced by a handful of companies in a small number of countries with a readily available technological substitute. What we could have learned, but didn't from this, was that the ozone regime, the ozone agreements, don't talk about emissions. They talk about the technology of production. Whereas what we've done with climate change is focus on the emissions and not, thus far, the technologies of production. The second analogy is the sulfur program, the US EPA's sulfur trading program. Basically, there was a long period of scientific investigation. There was something called the National Acidic Precipitation Assessment Program, or NAPAP, that produced vast amounts of science in the US, from which politicians cherry-picked the particular bit of science that agreed with their political orientation. Eventually, the EPA came up with this idea, let's cut through all of that, we'll come up with a sulfur trading program, which allows US utilities to trade sulfur emissions permits, thus enabling utilities in the eastern United States to continue to burn dirty sulfurous coal from West Virginia by trading emissions permits with those in the more western states who were burning cleaner coal, rather than having to ship the coal right across the continent. And it worked extremely well. So the idea here was we built emissions trading into the climate regime. Very nice idea. The trouble is, though, the reason why this worked so well was you had a small number of traders, electric utility companies, trading a single gas, sulfur, not multiple greenhouse gases, within a single legal regime to enforce contracts. None of those conditions applies with international carbon trading. Finally, why strategic arms reduction? What on earth could that have had to do with this? Well, actually, I can tell you that I know the man who was previously Al Gore's chief of staff, Leon Firth, who took the ideas from the strategic arms reduction negotiations into the climate framework. Many of you will not be aware that before he became an environmental policy wonk, Al Gore was actually most well known for being a national security wonk. And what we borrowed from there was this idea of mutually verifiable assured reductions. In the case of the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, it was reductions in nuclear warheads. That's quite easy to do because governments own the nuclear warheads and presumably they can count them. But if you're talking about mutually assured reductions in carbon emissions, that gets a lot more difficult. And in fact, building that condition into the policy framework has been a big stumbling block, particularly with China being very concerned about the idea of external verification of their emissions as being an infringement of their national sovereignty. So if these analogies and this conventional policy architecture is deeply flawed from the outset, what's the alternative? And I think the alternative is to reframe emissions mitigation as a technology innovation problem, very much along the lines of what we could have learned from the CFC's case and ozone depletion, but didn't work. Now, this is a complicated formula by an economist that scares the living daylights out of me. It probably doesn't out of the people in the room who are more accustomed to dealing with these kinds of equations. So I've reduced it to a simple version. Emissions are a function of population, wealth, and technology. So that gives us three policy levers we could pull, right? Unfortunately, the population lever won't work. If you want to affect emissions and in a way that's going to have an impact on carbon concentrations in the atmosphere this century, certainly in terms of mid-century, and we're talking about the 2 degrees, then you have to kill people. And even worse, the people you have to kill are the people in this room. It's Europeans, North Americans, Australians. It's not poor people in India and China and Africa. Probably not going to work in a democracy, right? I don't think many of us would vote for that solution. What about wealth? Well, we could restrict wealth. We know that works. We have seen, in fact, emissions dip along with economic collapses. That's happened in the past. We could engineer that. We could agree to some kind of regime of voluntary frugality. But I would actually argue that that's not morally acceptable. We've got 1.5 billion people on this planet without access to safe, reliable energy. I think that's an assault on human dignity that is absolutely intolerable. So part of the thing that we have to resolve is how are we going to get safe, reliable energy to 1.1 billion people without frying the planet? But we've still got to get that energy to those people. So, and I've already mentioned the fact, as George Bush said, Americans are not going to compromise their standard of living as they experience it in order to deal with climate change. So if population and wealth won't work in a democracy, what will? And I would argue it's technological change. And by the way, by technology, I don't just mean bits of kit. Technologies are social systems mediated by materials and devices. You have to understand that. You're talking about a whole system. Very often when people tell you we have all the technology we need to switch straight away into renewable energy systems, that's not quite right. Because solar cells and wind turbines, although they've come down radically in price over the last 10 years through incremental improvements, a lot of them actually carried out in China, are still too expensive to compete effectively with low-cost sources of energy, particularly shale gas, for example. And furthermore, we have a big problem, which is we don't have good ways to store large amounts of electricity in the grid, and you're dealing with intermittent sources of power. The idea has been floated by Stephen Chu, that in the former Secretary for Energy in the US, that that's not a problem because what you do is you put solar cells on everybody's rooftop and they have their own batteries. And so they do their own storage. That may work for very sprawling suburban kinds of developments. They won't work. That won't work in those parts of the world, particularly in Asia, where we have very rapid urbanization in high-rise situations. We're still going to need grid power. But I would argue that a technology approach doesn't require having a treaty of 190-odd countries in place with a uniform set of agreements. These are things that can be done and built from the bottom up. And I'm sure many of you have seen the reports of the recent agreement between China and the United States. I think that's an example of the kind of bilateral agreement that could be the beginning of something that could be expanded by bringing in the EU, by bringing in Brazil and India into that framework, whereby ultimately you get the dozen really big emitters committed to this kind of political policy approach, rather than having to have a universal treaty of 190-odd countries where everything has to be agreed up front before you can do anything. I would argue that the approach that I've described, which was actually outlined in the Hartwell paper, is an approach that can actually appeal to all of the three different worldviews. The concern and the focus on actually getting affordable energy to all, to the 1.5 billion people who don't have it, is something which is a high priority for people of a collectivist worldview. The opportunities that energy modernization and technology innovation present to firms and so on is something which is appealing to people whose orientation is towards the free market and economic development through the business route. And also the notion that you can actually then generate through this technological improvement energy independence for nations is something which surely is a priority for the hierarchists who are concerned with issues of energy security and the stability of society. So that's just one example. And now I'm going to quickly, in the few minutes I have left, give you another example that's pushing the boundaries a bit further than the conventional climate policy area. I was actually a member of the Royal Society's working group that produced this 2009 report on what's called climate geoengineering. For those of you who are not familiar with it, it's a very heterogeneous set of technological practices that are being considered that could be developed either to reflect some of the sun's energy away from the Earth in order to cool the planet in the face of climate change, or an alternative set of technologies which might draw carbon dioxide down from the ambient air. And this is driven very much by concern about the emissions trajectory that's shown on this graph. So geoengineering was initially proposed in 2006 by Paul Crutzen as a response to the lack of progress that was being made with the international negotiations that I've just been describing the problems with. Now, I want to emphasise no informed observer or participant in these policy and technology discussions but supposes that geoengineering could ever be a substitute for emissions mitigation. The question is, can it play some kind of a supplementary or complementary role to shave the peaks off warming, perhaps to keep us below a 2-degree or a 4-degree rise in temperature? So it's really a debate about could these technologies buy us time to follow through with a more thoroughgoing emissions mitigation agenda. And the most controversial of all of these is sulfate aerosol injection, this notion of putting sulfate aerosols into the stratosphere. It's likely that if we do this, that it would be fast-acting. It would be effective in cooling the Earth. We know from Mount Pinatubo's eruption that, in fact, sulfate particles in the stratosphere can bring about a cooling of the Earth. There's about a 1.5-degree cooling for a couple of years following Mount Pinatubo globally. And the actual implementation costs of doing it are probably relatively low. Now, of course, if it turns out that there are unanticipated or unwanted environmental side effects, the true cost of the technology could be enormously high because you could severely affect precipitation and agriculture. The climate modelling that's been done suggests we understand the temperature response to this kind of proposal quite well, but we don't understand the precipitation response at all well. And critics fear that we shouldn't do this kind of research, in part because of the so-called moral hazard problem, the idea that if we appear to have a get-out-of-jail-free card, that people will try less hard at emissions mitigation. There are also concerns that there's something intrinsically wrong with playing God consciously, although we've played God unconsciously with the planet for many decades, not to say centuries. But there are also concerns about governance challenges. Who would execute this technology? Who would decide how much of it to do? And what would happen if a country feels that it's been disadvantaged by the implementation of this technology? Might they actually go into counter-geoengineering and deliberately generate lots of greenhouse gases? So we know that, for example, Russia doesn't find the prospect of Arctic melting quite as daunting, perhaps, as many other countries do, because they see it as a possibility for freeing up sea lanes and for mineral exploitation. So there are a number of pros and cons with relation to this. And it is my personal view, and I emphasise it's a personal view, that we need to research this kind of thing much better, both in terms of the characteristics of the technology, the potential environmental outcomes, and the political and ethical dimensions before we think about any kind of implementation. But there are those who say that, in fact, we shouldn't even be doing that research, because that's the beginning of a slippery slope. The idea that even if we begin to do the research, that we will then eventually justify to ourselves the idea that it's okay to do it and we'll end up implementing the technology. I'm not entirely convinced by that argument myself. I think there's also the argument about the valley of death in innovation, which is we know that most innovations actually don't make it very far past patenting. The Patent Office actually issues death certificates for innovation in most cases. And we have put a lot of effort into trying to promote carbon capture and storage from power plants and a lot of effort into that, and it's not actually... there's negligible carbon capture and storage going on at the present moment. So it doesn't seem to me that the slippery slope is entirely convincing. Now, I'm not going to read this this whole extract from my friend and colleague Mike Hulme, who's actually one of the Hartwell co-authors, but Mike is one of those who opposes the idea that research should take place. In a nutshell, he argues, firstly, that we could never know enough about how sulfate aerosol injection would affect the climate system with any confidence, to sufficient confidence to implement the technology. Secondly, he says that the technology would be ungovernable because it would create security tensions between different countries that saw themselves as being winners and losers. And thirdly, that our ignorance saves us from folly because such technology is, in fact, intrinsically unethical. So that's one position. Another friend and colleague of mine, David Keith, an American engineer, takes a very different view, as you can see. David Keith argues that we already know quite a lot, that we've got a lot of information from volcanoes, etc., etc., and secondly, that we can learn more in incremental steps through a research program, and that far from it being folly, far from our ignorance saving us from folly, it will be folly to remain ignorant of our ignorance. So the debate between these two, I think, is clearly one that's not susceptible to being resolved entirely by evidence. It is a debate fundamentally about values in that area of worldviews in the Funtowitz and Ravetz diagram I showed earlier. And it's a debate really, I think, between Mike Hulme, who's at the bottom right-hand corner of the triangle here, and David Keith, who's probably somewhere halfway along the edge here. It's not just about debates between the corners. There are edges where, in fact, you can have two of these worldviews that can align against a third worldview. That's something that's very important to bear in mind here. So you have this debate taking place in this triangular debate. Other participants call respectively for, on the one hand, an international treaty to govern R&D. This is quite a popular position among German commentators, the notion that you would have to have a treaty in place before you can do the research. There are others, particularly in the United States and Australia, who argue that you shouldn't have any controls over scientific freedom. And then you've got Mike Hulme's position and that of various NGOs, such as the ETC group, saying we should ban research altogether. Again, the question is, how do we deal with this apparent impasse? How do we deal with this gridlock? And the response that I and a group of academics have proposed is the following, which is that we proposed to the House of Commons Science and Technology Committee in 2010 these five following principles, which we think should govern climate change, geoengineering research. I'm not going to go into them in detail, but I'm very happy to discuss them. And if you Google Oxford principles on the web, you can find the publication in Climatic Change, where they are outlined in some detail with the justification. But the idea here is that the entire research process ought to be governed by these principles. Some people have criticised them as being too general. They say they could apply to any technology innovation of this sort. And I say, why not, actually? But then what you clearly need to do, particularly in the case of geoengineering, because of the heterogeneity of the technologies that are being proposed that have very little technically in common with each other, is specific research protocols that will be established for each stage of the research as it's carried out, with a review at each stage that will look at how those principles have been applied in the preceding stage and how they will be applied in the next stage of the research before that stage of research is permitted. And again, this is something that can be built from the bottom up. You don't have to have an international treaty. You don't even have to have national law. Initially, at least, it makes perfect sense for this approach to be implemented by research councils, by university ethics committees, by professional scientific bodies and so on. As you build up in terms of the scale with respect to this sulfate aerosol research, you would then want to actually go to national legal frameworks and then ultimately international frameworks. But you don't need them now. we would argue, in order to be able to do this. And what we would hope is that these principles would provide a framework which would provide at least some comfort to those who are concerned about the slippery slope argument, that slope is at least going to be made bumpy and sharp rather than smooth and slippery. At the same time as acknowledging the desires of the people who feel that it would be folly not to investigate these technologies, to look at them in some rather more detail. So I would argue that this is an application of this idea of taking all three worldviews into account in trying to design a pragmatic way to go forward with this very controversial area of research. So I shall end by reiterating a few take-home messages. Perhaps firstly, that a lot of these high-profile issues that we face that seem to be framed in terms of being scientific disputes are primarily disputes about values rather than disputes about evidence or about science. That's not the case for all controversies. There are controversies that are closer to the origin in the Funtowitz and Ravetz diagram that can be settled by evidence. When you get out into those very high decision stakes or those very high ignorance levels of ignorance uncertainty, we are falling back fundamentally on values and worldviews, and we won't settle those by appeals to facts. Secondly, that the scientific credibility is largely based, public credibility for science is largely based in these cases on trust and on identification with shared values. So the people are going to look for information, for guidance on what to do from people they see as sharing their fundamental societal orientation as to the way they think the world should be run. And thirdly, that democratic pathways out of impasses and gridlock of the sorts that I've described requires reframing of the issue to address all three kinds of political and epistemic culture that I've described. And I think this is important because whilst you treat things as binary polar opposites, all you have is a switch. You can only go backwards and forwards between the two poles. As soon as you can put in place a third position, you then have actually the makings of a complex system and a complex evolution of the issue, which is never possible when you're only dealing with polar opposites, because you can sequence those three different ways in different sequences, different combinations, and so on, actually, which makes the whole system adaptable to changing circumstances. So that's the case that I wanted to make this evening, and I thank Sense About Science for the opportunity to do so. Thanks very much.
The Guardian.